Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we talk about the history of bodybuilding. And I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we have part two of our interview that we started last week. If you remember last week, we talked to Tom Terwilliger about the art of posing in bodybuilding. And we were supposed to have Sean Ray on the interview with us. And Sean apparently thought it was the next day. So I guess he got his phone about an hour after me and Tom started. And then he realized it was going on now. So then he called in. So we did another hour interview, and that's what we got coming on today. So we got Tom Terwilliger again with Sean Ray. We talked mostly to Sean Ray because I already talked to Tom for an hour. And we just talked about the art of posing and how it's really missing in today's bodybuilding world. It was really an interesting interview, and it was really fun talking to both Tom and Sean as opposed to just talking to one of them. And we really got some good insights into Sean Ray's posing and how he developed his posing routine and his thoughts on what's going on in today's bodybuilding, where really no one is making an impact with posing. No one's creating their own style. No one even has their own poses that we can call that's a someone's pose, like a Frank Zane pose or a Lee Labrada pose or a Sean Ray pose. I remember back in the 1970s when I used to go to the Mr. Olympia in Columbus, Ohio, Arnold and Jim Lorimer started to show off with like a backdrop, and you couldn't see the people, the bodybuilders, when they got up on stage. You could just see their silhouettes. So they would all take the stage one at a time, and they would hit their patented pose, and the crowd would scream because everybody would know who they are. And I don't think that could happen today because nobody knows who these poses are. Nobody has their own distinct poses anymore. So it's really a shame, and I hope this show does something to at least make a change in that direction. I think we had a really interesting conversation with both Tom Terwilliger and Sean Ray. We made some really, really interesting points. All right, before we get to that interview, I want to mention our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number, which is 813-922-8939, or you can reach them at their website, flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. They are out here in Tampa, Florida, but they will work with anybody in the continental United States. And if you tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, they will give you not only a free consultation, they'll also give you a 20% discount off your very first order. All right. So if everybody's back in the gym, if your gyms are open out there, I've got another really good interview coming up next week. You guys are going to be really excited about this. We got Lee Haney and Rich Gaspari talking about 1984 when they trained together. Lee, of course, won his very first Mr. Olympia in 1984. And Rich was still an amateur at that time, but he ended up winning the light heavyweight class at the MPC Nationals. And then he won the Mr. Universe contest a couple weeks later. So he got his professional card, his pro card. And so it was a great year for both of them. So I got to talk to both Lee and Rich, and we talked to them about their time together training for that whole year in 1984. So you're going to love that interview. That's coming up next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I've been using this Zoom thing that really got popular during this coronavirus, and I love it. It's so easy to talk to several people. So I was thinking of some more possible interviews that we could do. If you guys have any ideas, I had a few ideas of some old school guys we can get on together instead of just having one at a time. It might be a really interesting dynamic. You know, I was thinking like just thinking out loud, like Roy Callender, Danny Padilla, and Tom Platz all together to talk about the 81 Olympia. That would really be cool. I made contact with Ed Connors, who was the owner of Gold's Gym, along with Pete Kromkowski and Tim Kimber. Ed is a very knowledgeable man in the industry. He said He would love to come on the show, so hopefully we can get him on in the next couple of weeks. I also talked to Walter van de Braden, and I don't know how many of you remember Walter's name, but Walter was a judge with the IFBB back in the early 80s and the 70s. He is living in the Netherlands, but I contacted him. It's just a matter of getting in contact with him because of the time difference and stuff. But he said he's interested in coming on the show. So if you ever look at some of those old score sheets from like the 82 Olympia, 83 Olympia, you'll see Walter's name on there. He was one of the official judges. So he knows Arnold. He's got some really good stories. So hopefully we can make that connection soon. I also talked to John Little. John Little was a guy who used to write for Muscle and Fitness magazine. He was a real expert on Mike Mentzer, and he actually wrote a few books about Mike Mentzer. And he's also an expert about a guy that I really admired when I was growing up, Bruce Lee. And John's even done some documentaries. He's produced some video documentaries about Bruce Lee. I saw a few of them. He's very knowledgeable about Bruce Lee. So he said he would also be interested in coming on the show. He's a fan of the podcast, actually. He's been listening to a lot of the podcasts about the 1980 Mr. Olympia, and he's thinking about maybe doing a documentary about that. So I told him I'd love to be involved with that if that happens. So we got some good guests hopefully coming up. I'll just keep working on those guys. But like I said, next week, you'll all love this one. Lee Haney and Rich Gaspari together talking about their time training together as training partners back in 1984. All right, I am going to start another John Hansen Fitness Challenge on my website, johnhansenfitness.com. You guys might remember I started the first one in the middle of January, and it just ended on April 13th. So we had pretty good response to that, and then that kind of got derailed because of the coronavirus. In fact, the last 4 weeks was really tough for everybody who stuck it out, because the gyms were closed, obviously, and they had to find a way to train at home or find another place to go train. So it was really crazy, but we did have some good winners in that. And I'm going to have that report on my other website, johnhansenfitness.com. I actually have an interview with the winner of the contest, Paul Aliota, and that'll be up on YouTube, and it'll also be up on my website. So we're going to start another one. This one's going to be the second annual John Hansen Fitness Challenge, and it's going to run from June 15th, so that's about 4 weeks from now, and it'll go to September 7th, which is Labor Day. So it's going to go through the whole summer. So if you want to get in shape this summer, this is a really, really good deal. You just pay for a training and diet program, one-time charge, and then I will be your coach for the next 12 weeks, and I'll help you every week. Paul Aliota, who won the last one, I was helping Paul every week. He would send me his workouts, and I would write up new workouts, so he knew exactly what to do every week. And of course, I followed his diet too. And if we ever had any problems where he was, you know, he reached a sticking point, then I was able to adjust his diet. And that always happens. Every time you do a long-term diet, like a few months, you're always going to reach a sticking point, and you just have to adjust some things, which I'm an expert at doing, of course, because I've been doing this my whole life. So that will be starting on June 15th. So I will let you guys know more of the details about that, and we'll have some nice prizes and everything for the winners, top three winners, just like we did last time. All right, I do have some reviews here. If you guys have any emails to send me, you can send them to naturalolympia@gmail.com. So we did get some comments on our Tom Terwilliger interview from last week, which was part one. I posted it on my Facebook page. This is also available on YouTube too, so if you guys want to check it out on YouTube, just go to my YouTube channel, and we have the Tom Terwilliger interview on there also. So Tom said, what a fun conversation. The how, what, and why, the art of the pose, and why it's sadly missing in bodybuilding today. And then on my YouTube channel, on the video portion of the interview, I posted a video of Tom doing his posing routine from the 1989 Mr. Olympia contest, which we talked about in our interview. And he was freaked out about that. He said, wow, John, where did you find that 89 Olympia posing video? I looked high and dry for that footage to no avail. Thank you for including it and having me on as a guest. So I told Tom that I do have a copy of that tape from 89. So maybe I'll get a copy of it made and send it to him. Casey Kucharik, who was a top champion, said, beautiful pose, fantastic physique. And Tom replied, thanks, Casey. You were certainly one of the great champions, along with my dear friend John Defendis and several others that pushed me to pursue something greater than myself. Glenn Kinnear, my friend from Chicago, Mr. America from 1986, said championship physique. And Tom replied, high praise from Mr. America himself. Thank you, bro. Gennaro Farah said, one of the most impressive side leg shots you'll ever see. Francisco Rios said perfection. Sarah Bogaz said, talk about symmetry, balance, and hardness of the muscle. Here you go. Jerry Scalise said, that's a champion side chest. John Defendis said, incredible. Tom Terwilliger is world class. I'm so proud to know him and honored to be a lifelong friend. Eric Burke said, that was a great episode. Tom's always a great interview. Samir Banute, Mr. Olympia, 1983, said, beautiful body for sure. Being 250 or 270-pound bodybuilders doesn't mean much to me these days. I would look at bodies like Tom and appreciate real muscles, nothing fake BS. And John Torelli said, this side chest pose shows us exactly how to execute the pose. And then Tom chimed in again, and he said, the music I posed to at the 89 Olympia was coincidentally by a guy I used to perform with when I was touring with Brian Moss, Better Bodies, and Muscle Opera in New York City. Tom talked about that in our interview. He said, Tim Capello is his name. He says, the song was I Still Believe, which Tim performed in the movie Lost Boys. Great piece of inspirational music. And Joey Focal said hi. So a lot of great champions made some comments on the Tom Terwilliger interview. So thank you guys for chiming in. I've also got some comments on the YouTube page. The mayor of bodybuilding said, the lost art of posing. Tom had an outstanding physique and a winning attitude. I saw great posing at the NPC Mr. Long Island. Guys took pride in their presentation back then. Yeah, they sure did. Martin Black said, I feel that aging is hardest on people that put so much stock in their physical appearance. Something very sad there. I don't know if he's talking about me or Tom. The Odessa File said, Terwilliger appears to be in great shape. Jack Hammer said, great interview. I always think of the film Problem Child when I see Tom and the funny mom's knitting draw scene. Great to hear his thoughts here. Diana Power said, John, you're the best. Thanks for the motivational videos. You're welcome. Dumbo Palumbo. I'm not sure if that Dave, if that Dave's Palumbo or not, or just somebody posing as Dave, but he says, Tom's a close friend of mine for many years and definitely one of the posing greats of his time. Have you noticed how fabulous he looks for his age? Tom takes my fiber lice. Bobby DeMarco said, John, I have the 89 Olympia. Thank God we see some of Tom in that. Why in 91 do we get no Tom? No posing, nothing. Can't you ask these guys what the heck were in the weeders thinking, cutting either the routines or not showing them at all? Yeah, that was pretty surprising. I was surprised to hear that too, so I didn't know that. I have the 91 tape, but I haven't watched it in a while, but I guess Tom's routine is not in there at all, and I guess that was a great routine too. So that's a shame that they cut out everybody's – well, not everybody, but I'm sure they probably cut out the people that didn't make the top 15. I'm sure they cut their routines out. And finally, we got some reviews on our Bodybuilding Legends Show podcast, which is on Apple iTunes. So if you subscribe to our show on Apple iTunes, please do me a favor and go to the Apple iTunes page, and you can rate our show. And if you give us 5 stars, that's the highest rating. And you can also write a review. And if you read our review, I will read it on the show. So this one came from McCaff Kane, and it was written on May 20th. He said, John does a great job of keeping the beat of bodybuilding alive and well. From history to training and posing, John brings the best guests to discuss the best parts of bodybuilding, fitness, and physique. John has a great conversational style, and his podcasts often feel like sitting around and having a conversation with kindred spirits. Keep up the great work, John, and thank you for keeping the classics of bodybuilding alive and well. And this one was written by Brian. All right, this one comes from Australia. It was written on May 6th. It says, highly analytical podcast detailing a broad range of bodybuilders and related topics, always on topic, professionally presented, and awe-inspiring advice. John has been involved in the sport since 1977 when he was 14. And this one came from April 28th. Says the best bodybuilding podcast on the web. Wow, thank you. John combines an uncanny knowledge of bodybuilding history, incredible personal experience, being a top-tier competitive bodybuilder, and finally, an intoxicating love for the sport. I eagerly look forward to next week's episode. If you love bodybuilding, it's impossible not to love this podcast. Truly inspiring and legendary in its own right. All right, great. Great reviews. Thanks, guys, for posting those. And like I said, if you get a chance, please go to Apple iTunes and post your own review. I would really, really appreciate that. All right. Without any further ado, here is the second part of our interview with Tom Terwilliger, where we are joined by the legendary Sean Ray to talk about the very important topic of posing in bodybuilding. Here we go.
That's all right, man. We had a great conversation. We were talking about basically we were talking about, and of course, you know, your posing always comes up when it comes to some of the classic posing of the 80s, the 90s.
Yeah.
You know, the influence from even before that, Vince Gironda, Ed Corney. Well, yeah, let me ask you this, man, as long as John's not here. Who was, because you were, I mean, just first off, I was prepared to compliment you all the way. Now I understand why you wouldn't want to show up. I mean, look at what you're up against, man. Come on.
Yeah, right. Going to be on, I'm out.
But let me ask you something, because you're, I mean, so. Physique-wise, clearly you were one of the best physiques ever.
Thank you.
You know, so, I mean, there's no question about it. But your posing was also, like, dramatic and smooth and accentuated your physique specifically.
Yeah.
What was your early inspiration? Why?
Well, you got to admit, I mean, the story's notorious. My introduction was by John Brown, right?
John Brown.
And John, I think, the truth be told, he was probably more known for his posing than he was his physique.
True.
He was an entertainer. So I mean, I would imagine my tutelage coming in the game would be almost being introduced to Michael Jackson. Now everybody that tries to sing like Michael Jackson, singing was secondary, dancing was first.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't matter what song you're trying to sing, you're going to be trying to do his moves.
Right.
So and John was into that slow type music, but then he had this hip hop element. Before it was fashionable, I gravitated towards the slow stuff because it was easier to do. And it came from a place where it was like, almost choose the song first. Choose the song.
That's exactly what we just talked about. Yep.
Yeah, choose the music first, and then we start to kind of develop the routine. And then it got to a point where, naturally, as I got more popular on the guest posing circuit, I could kind of experiment with the different songs.
Mm.
The style was the same. It didn't matter what song you were playing because you're going to see that style all the way through. I never did stop the music and go into the hip hop stuff like Melvin Anthony or King Kamali or, mm-hmm. you know, some of those guys, they would start slow and then they go into that hip hop stuff. I was true to the art form because obviously as I learned from John, I also noticed Labrada. I also noticed Bob Paris. I noticed Roy Littlemyer. Coming up as a teenager, I went up against a lot of Roy Littlemyer proteges.
And mm-hmm.
The style was similar. So, what you get introduced to early on is influential throughout.
Yeah, no question.
My whole thing was about the presentation. And I won my first my first contest, I actually lost, but I won the Best Poser Award. In my second contest, I got the Best Poser Award. So that was almost like, it didn't matter if I won. I had to get the Best Poser Award.
Well, absolutely. That's the emphasis that we put on it back then, remember?
Yeah,
it was equal parts, man.
And the affirmation coming from John. It didn't matter if I won, but you better go out there and pose your ass off.
Yeah.
Well, Sean, that's what John and I were talking about that. We were like, you wouldn't dare let down your fellow competitors in the audience with a lousy routine and like you didn't put any effort into it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
John would have berated you if you did that.
Absolutely, because I think it was one of those things where they may not – people might forget whether you won, but, again, it comes back to how you made them feel. And when I watched John, and very few people, John wasn't very known in the States. He was more known over in Europe. But when he performed, I mean, I'm in the audience watching him guest post, and I want that kind of reaction too.
Yeah.
And so then when it finally became my time to do it in those early years, he was there. I'm performing for the audience, but I know he's watching me too. I gotta take it up a notch.
Right.
And then so my game was elevated for the first two or three years of my career. And, of course, you know, eventually I found my own way. I mean, John wasn't that influential after I won the Teenage Nationals, which was before the Junior World. So I was pretty much done with John by the time I was 19. And it wasn't done with him. He went back to Europe.
Right.
He went back to doing his thing. I realized I didn't need him as much or being codependent on him because I would just do what he did to me on other bodybuilders. I'd go to other gyms and beat the shit out of people. Because that's what he did to me at my gym. So I would take that to Bulldog Gym, to Long Beach Gym, to World Gym, and different places I would go to and find these guys that wanted to train hard, and I would just drag them out into the deep end and try to drown them the way that John did.
I can remember that.
Yeah, so that part of training stays with you. But then when it came down to performing, it was always – that stayed with me throughout my career that, like, I know – what's John going to think when he sees this type thing?
Right, right. Yeah. Yep.
Well, Sean, the reason why I thought of this, doing this interview, was because you just posted something on Facebook the other day where you were talking about the 88 Olympia and how all those guys were such great posers. So I thought it'd be great to pull you and Tom into this and talk about how great the posing was in the 80s. And what me and Tom just got done talking about was where he got his early influences. And like you said, you were absolutely trot by John Brown, but were you motivated by anybody else? Like the guys Chris Dickerson, Macklin?
Yeah. I wasn't sheltered. When I fell in love with bodybuilding, I wasn't sheltered to like just walk in John's shadow. He was actually mad sometimes that I would drive to Gold's Gym and I'd come back and I'd start talking about Mike Christian and Chris Dickerson. He didn't like those guys. He was like, well, what are you going down there like for? What are you going down there for? They don't know what the hell they're doing. They don't know shit. You know, he was like, you just do what I do. But I made those pilgrimages to experience different people and how they did things. But you got to remember, again, I came behind Terwilliger. He's a little older than me, but I saw what he was bringing to the stage. Very theatrical, dramatic. Russ Testo, another old school guy.
Mm-hmm. Russ Testo.
You didn't have to have a great physique for someone to take notice. I mean, we had a lot of guys that weren't champions that we remember that were great posers. They just weren't able to go up that ladder because they didn't have the physique to go along with it.
Right.
And that can be said with a lot of sports where coaches, for example, Charles Glass won the Nationals and he won the Universe. He did one Olympia, I think, and he was done. But he's trained how many world champions, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. He was a better trainer. He was a better coach than he was ever a bodybuilder.
Right.
Well, there's a lot of bodybuilders that were better posers than they were actually competitors that you wouldn't even know the names if I told you, because they were here competing in the Mr. LA and the Mr. California,
right.
Orange County competitions. But I noticed the guys. I noticed what Muhammad McAway was doing. I recognized what Bob Parrish brought to the stage. And I think I'm a thief of all of them. There's a little bit of them in all of the things that I did. I've never taken credit like, I'm the originator. I'm a copycat of John Brown, but if you look closely, you'll see a little bit of Samir. You'll see a little bit of Bob Parrish. Everything I did was stolen from other people. It's very hard to come up with an original pose.
Oh yeah.
Everybody's done the poses. I think it's how you string the poses together, and what type of music you use that can make you kind of more original.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I also think, and John, maybe you can chime in on this, because I think Sean and I'm trying to picture, but I think everyone has any great physique and good poser has sort of their signature a little bit, or it's a twist on something. You know what I mean? Your most muscular, hands together in the front, is a twist on. You know, I mean, I'm sure you look freaking awesome in the regular most muscular, but that is sort of like a signature for you. I think everyone has their signature that's just like they look good, and it'd be hard for anyone else to look as good in that pose. You know?
Yeah, and you could go by just dropping names like. If I think of Frank Zane, for example, there's some very Frank Zane-like poses that we can visualize.
Yes.
I can see, when I say Labrada, I can see Labrada doing very specific poses, one or two very specific, even with Bob Parrish.
Yep.
So that's true with a lot of the bodybuilders, Dorian Yates included. But today's bodybuilders, I couldn't tell you what the signature pose of most of the guys are.
Right.
And I couldn't tell you what the signature song is.
No, not at all.
I mean, back in the day, like when I started talking about the 88 Olympia, John.
Yeah.
I mean, how many years ago was that?
32.
So my point was like, when I think of Phantom of the Opera, I mean,
Phil Hill.
Phil Hill comes to mind, right? When I hear U2, the In the Name of Love, I always think of Barry DeMay. When I hear it on the radio. It takes me back to that.
Right.
I mean, even Mike, I could see Mike Quinn parading around the stage when he got, I think it was fifth place in that Olympia or sixth place. And even, you know, Gary Stridham's, the songs actually meant something to the routines. And I look forward to those bodybuilders because they were guest posing around the world using the same kind of songs, right?
Yeah.
Gary Stridham always posed to War. And when I ever hear War, what it is, you're good for, it's Gary Stridham. And somewhere along the way, we lost that. There's no signature anything for most of the guys.
I agree. Absolutely. And it's sad because, again, part of that is that the emphasis, you know, it's no longer equal parts. And John and I were talking about this in terms of, I mean, just you're tired. You're training for a competition. You're dieting. But you knew you had to get in front of that mirror. You had to work on that routine. You had to pose. And one of the things that, and again, I don't want anyone to just misconstrue what we're saying in terms of the routine is important, equally as important as anything. But it's also the ability to bring out your best physique on stage and be able to maximize, to know that when you hit this, that little piece of serratus that you want coming out is coming out.
Right.
And that requires equal parts diligence and effort from the training, the diet, and the routine and the posing. It has to be equal parts.
Yeah.
And you can call it attention to detail. I've always been aware that, you know, whatever I'm looking at in the mirror is what the judges are going to ultimately see. And I've got to be able to control all the moving parts. But I can tell you to a person, the majority of these guys, the last thing they want to do, getting ready for a competition, the week of the show, as they're dehydrated, as they're depleting, the last thing they want to do is get in front of a camera and pose. I used to do all my photo shoots a week out.
Oh, yeah.
The week out. They don't want to get in front of a camera, so you don't see those that depleted look because they don't have the energy. And they certainly don't want to go and do the posing first thing in the morning, at the middle of the day, and in the evening, which was three rounds of posing for me that last week. That was on top of what I was already doing in preparation for the show. I was doing it because I knew in my mind that Flex is doing it, that Chris Cormier is doing it. I just felt that everyone was doing it except Paul Dillette. We can count on the fact that Paul Dillette probably wasn't trying to pose.
Right.
When you have that in your head that you think the competition's doing it, and if you don't do it, you're going to kind of fall behind.
Yeah.
It's second nature that you do it, and then it's how do you make it all flow together? And so throughout all of my posing, guest posing and my practicing, the last thing I really needed to worry about was when I stepped on stage to the music, because it's already been rehearsed.
Yeah.
It's already been practiced. I knew exactly what you guys were going to see when I hit the pose. I'd be very comfortable in it. I was never looking, even when I got lost in my routine, you didn't know I got lost because I'm moving in a more of a slow, controlled manner. I turned the wrong way.
Well, that's great. I want to touch base on that, John. If you don't mind, let me just jump in there because that's something that a lot of guys like really worry about. You know what I mean? It's just like, oh, and this is one of the things we talked about this a little bit earlier. We touched base on it at least, which is, you know, having a routine, having to remember, it's a lot of stress, you know, so whatever. It's just easier to get up there and just freaking do whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that ability, I can't even tell you how many times I've lost my place in a routine and no one ever knew.
Right.
Yeah, you don't know. You just get back into the flow. You get back into the rhythm. And you realize later, you go back and say, oh, wow, I missed that. I skipped that twisting back shot completely. And who cares?
Yeah, but you're the only one that knows. It. Yeah,
you know?
You're the only one that knew.
Well, my training partner knew. He'd rub it in my nose.
Yeah,
but the thing about it is that I think the attention to detail coming up when I was doing the business, the attention to detail made all the difference in the world. I knew they weren't scoring the posing round as a professional because the person that won the contest always won the posing round, right?
Yeah, always,
It wasn't always the best poser. Even though some people got standing ovations, they didn't win the posing round. On the scoring for the pros, when the acknowledgement that round was no longer being scored, I think when the Federation took it away and said we're not scoring it, it doesn't count. I think the bodybuilders pretty much said, "All right, well, I'm going to do as little as possible to get my paycheck."
Yeah,
and it shows that today it looks like they're just up there waiting to get paid. It doesn't make any sense.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good point, isn't it, John? We didn't even really think of that because once that changed, and I had my own personal experience with that. You know, at two times competing against Albert Beckles, God, what an honor to compete against Albert. I mean, the guy was a legend, and he was always in great shape. I mean, he was well into his 50s, I think, when I was competing against him. And twice he beat me on the posing round doing the Albert Beckles shuffle. Albert Beckles shuffle. And I would bring the house down, and I was like, I'm looking at the score. I'll beat me on the posing round.
Because he
won the contest.
That's right.
And had I won the posing round, I would have won the contest. He won it. He was the better bodybuilder, deserved it. But you're right. Taking that away, that emphasis and that scoring away, it de-emphasized it for the athletes today, man.
Yeah, and to give it a little perspective, were you there? I think you interviewed me at the 87 Nationals, right?
I did. Absolutely. In fact, I was damn glad I won it the year before.
So the posing round, I believe, was supposed to be like 90 seconds.
Yeah.
Right? My posing routine was 3 minutes. Go back and watch it. It's 3 minutes and thinking 13 seconds.
Wow.
What?
Double the time. And you didn't know it because who was going to stop me? Like,
true. In the middle of it.
There was nowhere, yeah. There was nowhere to really stop the song until it crescendoed and ended.
Right.
Go, when you have time, go to YouTube and time that sucker out. It's over 3 minutes and no one said a word.
Yeah. The only guy that said anything was Daryl Stafford. Wasn't he second that year?
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
He was like, that son of a bitch, turn his music off right now.
Yeah, he's trying to pull the plug. And one of the things that Victor Richards was mindful of and told me, so he told the guy, don't stop the music. And, you know, Victor's like 100 pounds. He actually stayed with me that weekend. But it was very important to select the song that suited your personality. And that was one. I mean, that was a song that stayed with me through my whole career. I mean, I won the Nationals in 87 with it. In my final Olympia in 2001, I used it. Mm. The difference, I think, in those two performances for me was knowing, one, I was 100%, which I was in 87. And in 2000, I knew it was my last go-round, and I really – the love and the passion wasn't there. Mm. So the routine wasn't very effective. As a matter of fact, I think when I kind of cringe when I watch it because I could see the half-hearted effort that I made. And then when I come off, everybody goes, what a great routine. And I'm thinking in my head, that would have disappointed John for sure. Because that was that was no way on the level which I was, you know, that's my final Olympia. It should have been my best one, right?
Yeah.
But I think I was just very disenchanted with the direction, with the mood, with the overall tone of – where I was with bodybuilding. I knew it was my last one, and I didn't really feel like giving the speech. I'm like, I'm out of here.
Yeah. Hey, Sean, I'm glad you brought up that Dreamgirls routine, because me and Tom just had a discussion about how he developed his posing routines. And he said it was always the music, and he tried to get some kind of motivational music. And I remember when you did that routine at the 87 Nationals, I think a lot of bodybuilders were like, whoa, it's almost like you took posing to a new level, the stuff you were doing, the twist around, you know, when you went to that lunging pose, and just the music itself. I think a lot of guys wouldn't pose to music like that, but you made it, you killed it. So how did you come up with that routine to that Dreamgirls song?
So I had done that routine actually in a guest posing before I actually wound up there in Atlantic City.
Okay.
I won the Teenage America and the Junior World. And I think both of those were Luther Vandross songs. And then somewhere along the way, we found the Dreamgirls. I think I might have saw a play or I might have saw something, which is when I heard the song. Mm. And then it was just a matter of just hearing it over and over and over and over again. And then I did a guest posing to it, and it didn't look anything like it did at the Nationals. And again, that's where that synchronicity of being 100%.
Yeah, yeah.
And feeling it and then hearing the music. Because when I walked out on that stage, I mean, it looked like I knew everything that was going on. I was just really cocksure of what I was showing you guys.
Yeah.
And I wanted to go all the way to the very, very end. Not to mention, Lyle Alzado introduced me. Mike Cap right there. I looked down. I saw Jim Mannion. He handed me my trophy when I was a teenage national champion. I went to Atlantic City by myself. I'd never been to New Jersey. I flew alone. The only person I knew was Victor Richards when I ran into him. I ran into Stacy Kaufman, the owner of ProTan. He suggested that I needed this tanning stuff on. I was black, man. I went to Palm Springs, like Chris Dickerson said, get my color right. I got my color right. The goal was from the California in May to October was to dry out and do cardio and eat fish, according to Mike Christian. I did those things. And then I found that Dreamgirl song. And so when I showed up in Atlantic City, I was alone, and all these little pieces started falling into place, like, wow, there's Jim Mannion, there's Lyle Alzado, there's Mike Katz. You know, I'm hanging out with Victor Richards. I just felt really this is where I belong, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
I think I talked to Tom after prejudging, I think Friday night, I believe it was, and coming into Saturday night, I was like, where's my trophy? Where's that?
Oh, yeah.
I got this routine, and then I did my routine, and I felt comfortable and confident, and then Phil Hill wins the heavyweights. I'm going, holy shit.
Oh, I know, right?
And I had to watch him. I'm like, oh, my God.
He was so good.
For me, in my mind, when we got to the overalls, I thought the only thing that was going to win the overall title was my routine. Because I'm looking at Phil Hill like he's Victor Richards. He's a freaking mountain, right?
Yeah.
But I knew, I thought, I know I outposed that guy. And Vince Taylor, I met him as a teenager. He had a good routine, but I thought it was a little little subdued.
Yeah,
I thought the dynamic of my routine, the length of my routine, and the cocksure focus that I had was going to put me over the top. So if I had one thing that I felt put me over, it was my posing. And I stayed true to that throughout my career.
Yeah. And I agree. And that's when they were judging and they counted it. And I don't know if that actually made the difference or not. I think you had Phil, you know, your lines, your separations were much better. You know what I mean? I thought, and again, it was one of those things watching that and critiquing it, you know, for Muscle Sport USA, for Fox Sport. It was just, I was watching it closely and I don't think it could have went either way. You know, when I first saw Phil, I was pretty impressed, but you were impressive. But I want to go back to something real quick. Cause you said, and this is funny because you said you went to Atlantic City alone.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, we'd already done the interview and we got to know each other just a little bit via that. But I remember I was with my, with a gal and a friend. I gotta be honest, I'm very fortunate to always have like an entourage. I always had some friends that were supportive. But I don't know if you remember, but we're walking around a casino and there's Sean Ray after winning the Nationals, like at a slot machine by himself. Like, what the fuck is he doing by himself? Should be out celebrating with all his friends like, by himself, man.
Yeah,
I was actually dumbfounded by it.
The thing about it is, I've always been by myself. Mind you, I had some girlfriends throughout my career, but I lived alone. I trained alone. And I've always kind of patted myself on my back that I did everything alone, right? Like, I didn't count calories. I didn't have a guru. I didn't have a consistent training partner. But I've always given John Brown the props for introducing me to the sport of bodybuilding because that was my foundation.
Yeah.
But John didn't take me and pull me out of high school and drag me through college and throw me into the pro ranks. You know, we trained for about a year and a half together, and that was the foundation of my career. By the time I won the team nationals and junior world, I was on my own. So when I won the nationals and I was on my own, I kind of felt like, I don't want to fuck this up. You know what I mean? I'm just going to do it on my own. So I've gotten very used to traveling the world, and you know, it's really interesting because what's that movie that came out with the dude with Lady Gaga? They were doing the duet.
Oh, it was Star is Born, right?
Okay,
yeah.
So in my mind's eye, when I think of that, you know, the guy would go out, he'd sing in front of all of those fans, and he'd be the man, right? And then he wind up in a bar, you know, drinking by himself,
right?
And it was a very different world because he was by himself.
Yeah.
I come to like being by myself. When I got done guest posing, when I got done doing my things, I can kind of detox and not lose sense of who I was. I came up with Chris Cormier. Chris would be at the bar and partying at some nightclub with his clothes off and just tearing it all up. And these guys would go out on shopping sprees when we're over in Europe and spending all of their money. I was never that guy.
Mm.
I was all about doing the business, and I didn't want to screw it up by doing things that would be detrimental to my next workout, to my next contest, to my next preparation. So I was a little rigid, and I look back now and I go, I think that might have saved my life because, look, I mean, we were talking about Daryl Stafford. He's dead. Vince Comerford, I made a post of him on Instagram today. He's dead. I mean, how many of those guys I watch kind of come and go? Mike Matarazzo, Paul DeMeo.
Yeah.
I think I might have saved myself from a lot of things and a lot of vices by not overindulging with the fruit of my labor.
Yeah. Hey, Tom, I want to go back to what you just said, how – at the Nationals, the 87 Nationals, Sean's routine, I think, did make a difference. And I think, you know, if you look back at the shows in the 80s, the guys who came out with those really inspirational, motivating posing routines, I think that's got to make a difference with the judges. I know they stopped judging the posing after 2000 or whatever, but I would think back in the 80s and the 90s, if a guy came in, and me and Tom, we just talked about this, Sean, when you develop a posing routine, if – You can bring that motivation that you put into your training and you can somehow show that on stage with this really great motivational music. I think that's got to make a difference with the judges because the judges are human like us and we all want to be great bodybuilders. So if you can convey that with your posing routine, that's got to make a difference.
Well, I can tell you to a person, when I got disenchanted with what I was watching, I created the Sean Ray Best Poser Award. And I gave it away for 3 years after I retired at the Olympia. Wayne DeMille wouldn't allow me to give it away on stage because I wasn't a major sponsor. So I had a seminar each year the day after on that Sunday at Gold's Gym. And one of the years, I literally had, I'm no shit, I think 2003,
I had Jay Cutler, Ronnie Coleman, Kevin Lefroni, Flex Wheeler, Dexter Jackson, Lee Priest. I had the who's who, Dennis James, the who's who of bodybuilders doing the seminar the day after the Olympia with me at Gold's Gym. I would present a $10,000 best poser award. Melvin Anthony won it once, and Darren Charles won it twice. It was $1,000 of my money, but I would ask nine other sponsors for $1,000. And these guys would get this 10 grand. None of those guys, Melvin and Darren, were never a threat to win the Olympia. Can you imagine? You're in the Olympia, and you're 10th place, 11th place, and you get the best crowd response. They freaking love you, and you don't even get a dollar for your efforts. Thank God that the day after the Olympia, they came to my seminar where a collective, the sponsors that gave me the money would help me decide who would deserve the money. These guys got, you know, some compensation for making us happy, the fans.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I don't have to imagine what that's like. I didn't make the top 10 at the Olympia and I got a standing ovation. It was just like, but I got to be honest with you, that was a reward enough, but there was no money in it.
Yeah.
You know, and all those, you know, all that effort and all the money, and you know how much goes into training for a competition. So, and exactly, I had exactly that experience. And it's frustrating, of course, but the reward, and as you know, if you can move an audience, and you talked about this, the music, the routine, the ability to be able to tell your story or a story through your posing, enough to move an audience and inspire an audience and create some emotion, man, I'll tell you something. And that they express that in return is it's almost reward enough. Now, we need to be on top of it.
Following that up real quick. Well, really quick. So they didn't reward it. The judges didn't recognize it. The Federation didn't reward it. However, I was able to monetize and capitalize on it. And same with Darren Charles and Melvin Anthony with the guest posing that we got at it.
Darren was great,
We didn't have the social media to capture what was happening then. Like, you didn't see it. You only – unless you bought the Olympia video. I parlayed that the way that John Brown was doing in Europe. I would go on these tours, and I'd guest pose, and I'd be in nightclubs doing my posing routines. And I found that I could parlay that effort into dollars and cents. It made sense for me to do a good routine, because then I would get rewarded later, even if I wasn't getting rewarded on the Olympia stage.
I agree. John and I talked about that too. Yeah.
Sean, do you think you were getting offers to guest pose because of your posing ability, not just because of your physique and your standing?
Let's be honest. It was a combination, because I wasn't the biggest. I didn't bring the freak factor. Like, if you brought in Paul Dillette to guest pose, you're bringing in a freak, right? They knew they were bringing in a freak. You're going to have this big monster. But Paul would show up wearing shorts that were, you know, cut off at the thighs. Mm-hmm. And he would come in and he wouldn't tan himself. And then once you got over that initial standing relaxed front double bicep pose, you can kind of like – it's a mediocre physique at best. It's off-season.
It's over from there.
Yeah, it's downhill from there. But for me, you know, I could come in mediocre shape, but I could still move the audience.
Yeah.
And most of the people I was guest posing for, I would be coming back years later. Yeah. And I was always in my mind thinking, it's about the sequel, because really the reward is on the sequel. If you can get to these places somewhere down the road, that's where the real money is made. And that's why what made Sylvester Stallone a star. Arnold Schwarzenegger with Terminator 6 and 7 or whatever the hell. Mm-hmm. That extra revenue comes from being able to go back. And I went to most of the places I posed for. I went back more than once.
Okay. Now, Sean, I wrote down some of your great routines in your career. You know, of course, you got to mention the 87 Nationals when you did the Dream Girls. That first Ironman victory when you did the Luther Vandross.
Luther.
94 Olympia also. You also did
Aerosmith.
You seeing that notice on there?
Yeah.
1993. I mixed it up. I did a fast routine too.
Aerosmith. Didn't you do Dream Girls? Isn't that the year that you should have beat Dorian?
Well, going into the 94 Olympia, mind you, I was third in 93.
Right.
And Flex Wheeler had his car accident. And Flex and I were on good terms. He actually got to look at me through my posing as I was preparing for my show. And before he got in his car accident, he was kind of checking in on me because he couldn't compete in the show.
Mm.
Flex was the last person that saw me leave for Atlanta in 1994.
Okay.
But we got word that Dorian had tore his bicep, got word that Flex Wheeler was in the car accident. I thought, I got to go to the money. I got to go back to the money.
Yeah, man.
That was a routine I thought would help me get over the top. And of course, it didn't. But again, Dorian won the posing round. And I think a lot more people talk about my posing routine in Atlanta, Georgia, than they did about the fact that Dorian actually won.
Yeah, it's interesting. Dorian, as great as Dorian was, I don't ever remember like any kind of dramatic routine. And again, listen, you know, one of the things John and I talked about was that, you know, the products of the 80s into the 90s, everyone posed. Everyone had, you know, knew how to present themselves and respectfully presented to the audience the physique in the best possible light. But there were those who just didn't, it just wasn't dramatic. You don't remember. I don't remember any of Dorian's routines at all. No.
And that's kind of like, I mean, and I had this conversation the other day about Dexter because he feels some kind of way about me. But Dexter's been around for almost 30 years, won an Olympia, 9 Arnold Classics. I can't think of one of his, I can't remember one of his routines that actually stands out.
Yeah.
I can't put a song to Dexter Jackson. Like even Flex Wheeler has some signature stuff. And I remember him posing to LL Cool J. And I remember Flex for a lot of different reasons, but like, as decorated as Dexter is, there's not a lot of meat on the bone when it comes to that posing round.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So, Sean, when you were developing a posing routine, did you get the emotion of the music? Like, did you pick the music first and then said, okay, I'm gonna get the poses that are gonna match this music because this music is so inspirational?
No, I mean, it got to me to a place where, again, I think I said this in one of my DVDs, like, I made love to the stage. That was kind of something that John Brown always said. You got to make love to the stage, man. You got to make love to the stage. So it was all about the love music, and I liked that kind of music. Like, okay. I couldn't move to a rap. I can't put my hand in my ear and get the crowd clapping their hands. It was like I'm performing and they're watching me. I want to draw them into me, continue to make eye contact with them. But I got to feel the song and I got to move to the song. So I would find songs that I liked.
Okay.
I mean, I posed to Rick James and Tina Marie, Fire and Desire, Keith Washington in 1998 in New York City. You know, I thought about doing something with the New York. I think, Tom, did you pose to Frank Sinatra before or not?
No. I think, you know who did, though, was, you imagine, Russ Testo did a Frank Sinatra thing. Yeah. And he had the hat, the whole deal, you know?
Yeah. Yep. But when I was going to New York, I was thinking some Broadway-type stuff. But then I wound up going with Keith Washington, but I really liked Luther Vandross. Luther was my go-to guy. And then I saw Vince Taylor kind of sneaking in there with that.
Yeah.
That music. But
you had Mariah Carey too, Sean, that one time.
Yeah, Mariah Carey in 92 and 99.
Yeah.
I would kind of always go back to the people that I liked. And it was Luther, Mariah Carey. I mean, I had my style. I would have loved to do one to a Whitney Houston song. I just didn't get around to it. But I was comfortable with what I brought to the stage. Sometimes people go, oh, no, not this song again, or, oh, my God, it's going to be boring to watch, because my physique wasn't something that would change from year to year. I was very consistent, like Labrada and Muhammad McAway. You knew before I walked out on stage what you were going to get.
Yeah.
It wasn't going to be something shockingly and amazing, but it was going to be something that was going to be well put together, well prepared. It would be tasteful, and there weren't going to be any real big surprises. And you know, when I was there for a decade, year after year after year, actually for 13 years, you probably can get bored with that style. Like in 93, someone kept telling me I needed to do something different. So I tried Love in the Elevator and it wasn't really me because I'm not that cheerleader type guy. I did it. And I, in my mind's eye, when I got done and I got third place, it was a forgettable routine for me. And I was doing it to try to rile up the audience and suck them in some kind of way. But I needed to go back and be true to myself, which was the same with my physique. I didn't want to change what got me there. And for that reason, either you loved it or you got bored with it. And while I stayed kind of the same, remember the physiques that were coming and going. I mean, Jean Pierre Fuchs was coming in. Marcus Rule was coming in. Gunther Schlierkamp was coming in. Here came Jay Cutler. I mean, I was there for three freaking decades, right?
Yeah,
so I had a lot of different physiques coming and going, but my consistency seemed to keep me there because I was staying true to what got me there.
Yeah. And you know what? And John, that goes back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of the, you know, the best routines that someone could possibly present to an audience is one that represents your best authentic self, man. Yeah, if you're not being authentic with yourself, then you don't feel it. You can't get into the flow. And you talked about that in 87, Sean, that you were in the flow. All the pieces are coming together. The mindset was there, the confidence, and you knew this could put you over the edge. And you get into that flow state, like a skier or a climber or a power, whatever it might be. And bodybuilders experience that well. In fact, this is something I think that a lot of the newer athletes are missing out on in terms of that real flow state that's elusive, but you can only achieve it on stage when you're fully prepared, you're being completely authentic, you're in sync with your music, and you are in that moment, and you convey that to the audience. That's a flow state. You feel it. The audience freaking feels that. That's the emotion they get, man.
Yeah, I mean, you'd be surprised. I didn't know what I was bringing to the stage in Atlantic City in 87, but what I've heard in the years since from people that I didn't even know were there, the way it impacted their takeaway from it. I remember Derek Whitsett, the late Derek Whitsett from New Jersey. Mm-hmm. He won the Nationals somewhere in the early 90s, I believe. He came out to train with me. Anyways, he was at that show, and he was telling me about it, because to me it was all a blur. I mean, I think I went on the boardwalk a day or two before the show, and that's when I ran into Mike Tyson, because I think he was fighting there the week after. I think he was fighting Terrell. And I ran into Mike. I was so amazed I ran into Mike Tyson. I kind of forgot where the hell I was at. And that's when he fought all of his fights at the convention center. I've run into so many people that were there. Sylvester Solomon. What's the guy? Vinny Galante. I met a lot of the East Coasters that I would have never met. Mm. That came to that show and pretty much said it was a game-changing routine that did affect the way that they were going to present themselves in the future.
Yeah.
That feels good.
Yeah.
Feels good.
Well, I think you made a great point when you did that post on Facebook and you were talking about that 88 Olympia, and you just mentioned it, how so many of those routines with that music, we still associate that routine with that music whenever we hear it. And you just don't see that anymore. I mean, that was just basically a product of the 80s and 90s, I guess. Right, Sean?
Yeah. And you got to remember, when you look sideways, I was young, so I was really young. I was 22, 23 years old. But when I looked at another guy, they were all veterans. I mean, even Gaspari was pretty much a veteran at that stage. He'd already been second like two times, and he got a third place. Labrada was a seasoned professional.
Yeah.
Barry DeMay would have been kind of a new arrival, but he brought a different flair in his – the way he hit his poses, the flexing Dutchman. I remember in 85, I think it was, he won the Universe. And – I saw Mike Christian at Gold's Gym. I had a little relationship with some guys that were doing the business. And then I was there in 85 winning the Junior World Championships in Australia. And Albert Beckles was the guest poser. He just got second to Lee Haney in 1985. Yeah. And of course, Albert's not going to be someone I'm looking at for guest posing or for posing tips.
No.
If anything, something, learn what not to do. That's true. Him, Berto Fox, Gary Stridham, Paul Dillette. There's bodybuilders out there you look at and you learn what not to do.
And
I learned, I was looking at those guys coming up very early, like, man, I don't want to go out there and look like, I hope I don't come off like that. Some of them were seasoned pros and they just didn't look like they were in sync. Even Robbie Robinson, I believe that year in 88 kind of had like a little, you know, kind of a funky routine, but it wasn't really a routine. It was just trying to get through. You could tell when someone's trying to get through a song, right?
Yeah.
And then you could tell when, uh-oh, look at this guy. He's coming on. We're about to see something.
Yeah.
That 88 Olympia is chock full of guys that came out there with something to present.
No doubt. You know, I wanted to touch base because, you know, a lot of the guys that we talk about that are great posers, including yourself, Sean, it's just, and Labrada, it has this more smooth, open hands, and you kind of these great rotations. But you know what was interesting? I remember when I saw Rich Gaspari compete at the, and again, it was against Albert Beckles. He lost.
Yeah.
And I forget what year it was. It might have been
85.
It was 85. Yeah. And it was in New York City. And I remember going to that. And, of course, Richie shocked us all, you know, because he won the light heavyweight year before and he came out with this fucking monster body, you know?
Yeah, right.
I mean, just you know, vascular back and everything. But totally different. And I still remember it because it was to Frankie Goes to Hollywood, relax. dun, 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 dun. And they're just like, and he had, and he just did just like, it was just like, it was this kind of thing and stuff, you know what I mean? But it was like, but it worked.
Yeah.
Right, for his style.
It worked. He wasn't trying to be a ballet dancer. You know what I mean?
Right. For his body.
Man, it just freaking, it was like choreographed and it freaking worked. And it was like, but again, well, I wanted to say that because not everybody has to be a ballerina up there. You know what I mean?
No, they don't. But here's the thing. A lot of guys, they'll have their trainer or their guru, and that's not an area that they talk about. Mm. Like the trainer and the guru will get the diet together and get their contest prep together and maybe try to help them make some money here or there. But there's no one there trying to get their posing together. Yeah. Like, look, we're going to be ready. You got the physique. You're dialed in. We're ready. Now we got to get this other element ready. And there's no one there on those 11th hour, wherever they're competing at in the world, to be like, okay, let's work on your posing. Some of these guys travel with their wives or with their girlfriends, others with their trainers or their gurus. None of them are seen actually doing the practicing of a routine.
I
see a lot of shows. I go all over the world. I have yet to see like a bodybuilder somewhere working on a routine. I walk in and go, hey, what are you doing? Oh, I'm working on my routine. It just doesn't happen.
That's sad, man.
Yeah,
you know, I'm working with a young guy, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention his name. His name's Nick Nat. He placed in the Nationals last year. He's a heavyweight, big muddler lover. But we put a lot of work into the routine. I'm not always, you know, thrilled with how it comes out. It's just his signature. It's how he does it. But we put a lot of work into the routine. And the reason I bring that up is because, and this is something maybe you guys, because you guys are more dialed into what's happening today than I am, certainly, you know. I still watch and follow it. But why? Why? When did the... Like the distorted arms up. When did this happen?
Yeah,
and probably, why like is Harley it continuing?
It's the Harley Davidson syndrome, right?
What? It's like, yeah, I've got my ape hangers, man. Next thing, it's going to evolve into this kind of thing. It's like, I'm up here. Yeah.
The invisible lat syndrome.
Why? When did that become cool, man?
I don't know, man. But I think the older you get, the more observant you are of the changes that are not happening. Our sport is not evolving in a direction where it should be on a whole nother level visually, creatively and innovatively. Yeah. I mean, I would think by now we would see some great, I mean, some guys in the early 2000s, I think Melvin and King Kamali and Darren Charles, they were actually trying to get some things done.
I agree.
Sergio Oliva Jr. just won the Arnold Classic Best Poser Award, $10,000. But when I was watching it before they presented him with it, first of all, I didn't have a best poser. You have to have somebody. I'm like, wow, I just saw 12, 13 routines, and I don't remember any of them. But when he was posing, he was very rushed. And when I went back and watched it on the web, it was unpolished, and a lot of the poses weren't executed. They were stopped midway through, and he was positioned wrong. But then I thought, well, he's the best of what was there. And it wouldn't have passed the sniff test in the 80s or even the 90s by comparison. Right.
Yep.
So he got $10,000 for it, though.
Wow.
Same thing with the Olympia, too, last year, Sean. I was there at the Olympia, and I know you were doing the commentating. And, man, I didn't see one memorable.
Thank God they didn't have a Best Poser Award, because I would have no clue who to give that to. And you know, I haven't missed the Olympia since 88. I like to brag about that. But in going, like, somewhere along the way, I stopped forgetting about who did what, because I mean, the Olympia is not even a year old, and I can't remember a song, and I can't remember a routine, and I was there glued in for 2 days straight.
Right. Wow. Exactly. And
part of the problem is this is so much. You know, part of it is certainly that you're right, that the effort isn't being made to really being memorable and moving the audience, because if you were memorable and you moved the audience, you'd be remembered for it.
Yeah.
But there's also so much. It's so spread out. There's so many different divisions, and it's hard to keep track. It's like
you got to remember. But even with all of that window dressing, I'm still a bodybuilder, so I'm studying the bodybuilding. I'm there for the bodybuilding. Classic physique has my attention a lot more, because those guys realize the importance of a posing routine, and I think they believe that a posing routine can make it or break it.
Yeah,
you know, guys like Breon and Chris Bumstead, the classic physique was designed for that. And even though they're getting peanuts by comparison, I think in the future it could be the one that people start paying attention, because they are giving the fans something back. Like, they're trying to give something back to us. And if the eyeballs start to shift from the bodybuilders to the classic physique, the bodybuilders are going to have to take note, because we're going to have to start rewarding the Classic Physique financially for their efforts.
Yeah.
Well, what amazes me, Sean, and I can't believe no one else has thought of this, all these other competitors, we're in an age of social media, and things are being shared on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube. No one can come up with a killer routine and realize the impact that's going to have. I mean, you know, imagine how many times that's going to be shared all over the world.
Oh, the viral effect of a routine. It's like, you got to see this routine.
Why wouldn't you put the effort into creating a killer routine with killer music, motivational, and realize the impact that's going to have? I mean, it's unbelievable.
Well, if you remember a couple of years ago, Arnold was complaining about the stomach distension and the distended stomachs and all of that stuff. And, of course, when they took the title from Phil Heath and gave it to Sean Roden, because that's how I feel. I feel like Phil didn't necessarily lose the title. I felt like they took it from him because of his stomach.
Yeah.
They'd been saying it for years that this was going to happen.
Right.
And then they finally did it. But the guys are really aware that they've got to keep their stomachs reduced. Well, I imagine if someone in our federation, the judges or whatever, on some level, my dog,
what's going on over there, man?
my dog making its debut. On some level, if the federation says, listen, guys, you're doing it to yourself. If you don't step up your game, we're going to lose our audience.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? I know that the UFC, when it first started, you could eye gouge. You can do literally everything. Kick the guy when he's down, smother him, choke him, literally do all of these things.
Yeah,
go, look, you know, it looks too much like cockfighting. We've got to have some, boundaries if we're going to make this grow. So in order to make it not so brutal, if you can say that about the UFC, they put some rules on that stuff. Well, I think from the higher-ups, not from Sean Ray, an old veteran, but from the higher-ups, from the Federation, from the people that write the Olympia checks, the Arnold Classic checks, before the contest, at the athletes' meetings, or a memorandum that goes out somewhere in the middle of the year, if you're not making the effort, we're going to cut your music. You know, there's got to be a consequence for somebody that flies all the way in from Germany and goes, play whatever you want to play, and then stands there and does the monkey dance. I mean, get the hook, turn the music off, get them off stage.
That's serious. That's consequences in action right there, man. I want to see that.
Just turn the lights out. Like, who wants to
do that? That'd be great.
That's what I used to do in my gym back in New York. You know, when I first took over this gym back in Long Island, and it was an old beat-up gym, and nobody had their weights away. It was a mess. So we plan on renovating the whole thing. I'm off subject, of course, but man, when the guys would just leave their weights out, I'd bowl them out, I'd yell at them, I'd do the whole thing. And I just started shutting the lights out and the music off.
Yeah, there you go. Hey,
somebody left 400 pounds on the squat bar. Lights are going out, music's going off until the shit is stripped, man.
Hey, you guys, both of you guys have MC'd shows. How many times have you been standing there and you say, competitor number 7 from Hackensack, New Jersey, and they walk out there and the music doesn't come on and they're standing there and they're looking at you and you're kind of like, I'm not the music man, and they're looking at you, and you're looking at, and then finally when the music comes on, they do some shit that a 7-year-old can do.
Right, you could have done it without the music. In fact, it would have been better.
They walk off the stage, and I'm standing there with the microphone going, that's what we were waiting for?
I mean, I've seen it. It's happened, man.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
It's horrible. But again, that's the kind of stuff that I think I always – wanted to make sure they couldn't say about me. You don't have to like my style, but the last thing you're going to say is that I didn't try and I didn't give you an effort, or I didn't put the consideration in to prepare myself for what you're about to see. And the reason why I think it worked for me is because I got the work as a result of my effort. I got the work after that. No, I didn't win the Olympia. 13 times I tried to do it. I never won, but I was one of the more busier bodybuilders. It took me around the world. My posing style and my effort gave me a career. So those bodybuilders out there that realize going into a show that they can't win, they have to find other ways to win. My other victories were coming from the fact that I think my efforts were being rewarded by people that were taking notice. And now with social media, we're begging for a great routine. Yeah. We're clamoring. We're waiting for someone to come out and do something that we can share and repost and tell people about.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, in terms of the growth of the sport, That's the kind of thing that we need. We need something that's going to dazzle people. That's going to say, hey, you know what? Look at this thing. This is more than just some guy greased up there posing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's exactly what we need. Somebody has to step up.
We're missing it. We're missing it badly. Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking about it. I mean,
yeah.
I was just sitting there reminiscing, and I thought, you know, what was the best time in bodybuilding? And most people would think I'd say 94, 96 when I got second up and almost won it. But, like, the best time was I was a fan on the Olympia stage with no horse in the race. I had no shot at winning. And in my mind, I internalized that I'm at the Olympia.
Yes.
I need to pay attention. I didn't have to go back and watch the videos of these guys posing. I was staring from behind the curtain and looking on the monitor at what in my mind was history. I'm watching these guys do what they do, which inspired me to do what I was doing. And I don't think we have a lot of the athletes today don't have that appreciation.
No, no. Hey, Sean, I know you're a big sports fan. Did you watch the Last Dance, the Michael Jordan documentary?
Yeah, I've been watching it. I'm only up to number 5. I haven't been watching it with consistency. I've been watching a lot of Netflix. I'm only on 5. I think there's 10 episodes, right?
10 episodes, yeah. I just finished up last night. Yeah.
I hear it's great, man.
Oh, it's amazing, yeah.
I hear it's really inspiring, yeah.
I thought a lot about bodybuilding when I saw it because the guy was so competitive and he was such a hard worker and he wanted his work on the basketball court to speak for him, you know, and they were saying what an iconic figure he was, and this is way before social media, but it was just the effort he put into being the greatest basketball player ever that made him such an iconic figure around the world. So it kind of related me, you know, I kind of related it to bodybuilding. And, you know, Tom, we were talking about how we used to put that effort into our posing practice. And, you know, like Sean, you were saying, you want to be remembered for that. When you step off the stage, you want people to remember that posing. And it's kind of the same kind of mindset. You know, you got to really work hard and put in that effort. And if you do that, I mean, you know, we could change bodybuilding if these guys would put that kind of effort in like Jordan did with basketball.
Yeah, well, to your point, I was very aware of the era that I was coming behind. I was coming behind the era of Muhammad McAway, a two-time first runner-up in 83 and 84. I was coming behind Samir Banu in 83 when he won the Olympia, and I was right in the smack in the middle of Lee Haney.
Yeah.
And again, Lee Haney was 5'10", 250. And then there was Dorian Yates, 5'10", 260-ish. And then, of course, Ronnie Coleman, 5'10", 280, 290.
Right.
So I arrived at the wrong time, but I knew in my mind, and I always believed, on any given day, these guys can be beat. First, I knew that in my mind. On any given day, these guys could be beat. But I've got to be complete, and I've got to be professional from head to toe. And my mindset was always taking me back to, what was Muhammad McAway doing, and what was Lee Labrada doing that made them so successful? Because Lee Labrada had Lee Haney to contend with. Muhammad McAway had everyone, because he's about 5'4".
Yeah.
So I came up in 1988 on my arrival. I didn't come to fruition until 1990, because 1988 I was just barely getting my feet wet. But by 1990, when I was third, I thought the only way I'm going to win this thing is if I am complete, because I couldn't out-muscle him. I was never going to be bigger. I was never going to be the freak factor. And I thought, all right, this is Lee Haney's sixth Olympia championship or seventh Olympia win in 1990. His eighth was in 91. All right, now it's my turn. Of course, I didn't see Dorian coming, but the mindset for me was, if I'm going to beat Dorian, I've got to be complete from head to toe, and my posing would help me get there. And I still believed it all the way through until I didn't believe it anymore and I won.
And it showed, you know.
I walked away. I quit, you know. That's basically what happened. I quit. I gave up.
Yep.
But I always believed that performance would put food on the table. That performance would take me places that my physique couldn't take me. And just the attention to detail would keep me relevant. So I when you mentioned Michael Jordan, we know Michael was not a shit talker. He wasn't a media guy. I mean, it's amazing that he's talking about all this and they documented all that, because his basketball did. It spoke for itself, and he was the greatest. I came up sandwiched in between 22 years of three guys that won consecutive Olympias. The only way you were going to notice me is if I was talking a little bit of shit from time to time. So in 1991, I printed up a t-shirt that said Ray versus Haney. I'm like, screw everybody else. It's me against Haney.
Right.
I won the Arnold Classic in 91, and I felt like I was going to be next in line. I mean, who else is there? Of course, I didn't see Dorian. Of course, I didn't see Dorian. And I also didn't see the fact that I was going to be as busy as I ever was after winning the Arnold guest posing, which gave me a ton of practice. Guest posing is a great place to practice. I was on stage every weekend.
Yeah.
And by the time the 91 Olympia came around, I ran out of gas. So I had to kind of reinvent myself. But I went from fifth to fourth to third to second. And then I got back down to fourth and then back up to third. So I was getting kicked around in that top five. And on any given day, I thought, my posing will help me get there. Yeah. There's no reason why any bodybuilder competing today can't believe that, look, if I don't have it physically, you're here. You got the pro card. It's a pro show, and all eyes are on you. You better leave a mark. You better make an effort. You need to get something for it. And that's why I put such a premium on posing, and it paid off dividends for me financially.
Yeah, it's exactly right, because the same thing for me. I mean, it was just like, you know, I wasn't the biggest physique. I wasn't the best physique. There was a lot lacking. It was like, hey, it was thrilled to death to make it to the Olympia. I still had that image in my mind, that kid in the audience, the kid sitting in the audience. You know, now I'm backstage, I'm at the Olympia, I'm at this thing. It's just amazing to me. But again, those 3 years or so as a pro, it was like, God, I was all over Europe constantly.
You were
invited to the Grand Prix. It was just like all because of the posing. Well, the physique had a little to do with it, but it was the posing, man. And then so I built a career. I got sponsorship because of that. And that's something that just, I can't replace it. And when someone says, I remember that routine, or I remember this routine, or Peter McGuff says this about that, you know, just like, you're absolutely right. Because not everybody is going to rise to the level or be able to become a Mr. Olympia. But if you turn pro, if you have that honor, man, be remembered for something that you contributed, for the way you moved someone in that audience, you know?
Well, we could have never predicted we'd have YouTube or even the social media, right? When we could have never imagined it.
Right. No.
I'm grateful that I took the time to go the extra step, because I'm not embarrassed by any of my work. I'm really not.
Right.
But there are guys I came up with that I look at, I go, oh my God, what was he thinking? And you don't get a do-over. It's there forever.
That's it.
And now 35 years later, we're still watching Sean's routines on YouTube. So it did make a mark.
Yeah. I mean, if nothing else, I feel good about that. But you'd be surprised at how many people try to hang their hat on the fact that I didn't win the Olympia. No, I go, I didn't win it. Neither did Gaspari, neither did Labrada, Lavroni. I mean, a lot of guys didn't win the Olympia. But there's a lot of things about those guys that didn't win the Olympia we remember, and a lot of things that we missed because of the effort and their passion.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, John, do you mind if I ask John a question real quick? Because this has to do with, again, a common friend of ours, John DeFendez.
Sure.
Who won the USA, looked absolutely brilliant, fantastic, like 215 or something like that. And then the same thing, he was like getting these guest posing, leading up to Night of the Champions, and it was completely deflated. It almost was too much. I mean, did you ever have that experience where it just like burned a little bit?
Yeah, that happened to me in my first Olympia. I won the Nationals in 1987, and I got on a lot of magazine covers that started breaking around January, February. The magazines started coming out, and then the work started to come, and I had to kind of like, and I hadn't been traveling, so I had to kind of like temper it between getting ready for the Night of Champions, which I just thought I was going to walk in and win, qualify for the Olympia, and then get ready for the Olympia in the summer. But that 1987 Nationals, you know, I moved out of my house, and I moved out of my mom's house and into my apartment. I bought my first car. A lot of changes happened for me in 1988 on the way to the Olympia that we dream about happening as a bodybuilder for us, right? And so the contest preparation, it took a back seat. So here I was trying to do everything I could to get ready for this 88 Night of Champions, and nothing was happening for me. I got beat. I was fourth place there. And remember, the top five qualified you for the Olympia. So getting fourth, I could breathe a sigh of relief. But that was a good lineup. Phil Hill, who got beat at the Nationals, went back to New Jersey. He probably didn't guest pose. He probably just trained every day to beat Sean Ray at the Night of Champions.
His revenge.
Then there was Robbie Robinson, who had already won the Night of Champions. And then there was my idol, Bob Paris, from 1980 Nationals. So I lost to all three of those guys, got fourth at the Night of Champions, and I was happy. And I think that might have made me it made me complacent, because I should have been mad. I should have been upset. I should have put my foot to the metal. But I went back to college after that show, and I kind of cruised through the summer of 88, guest posing. It was the first time I went out and posed out in Florida back in 1988. And then I cut off my guest posing. I think it was in August, and the Olympia was in September. Nothing changed from May of 88 to September of 88 because I couldn't get my body right. I couldn't get my mind. When I trained for the 87 Nationals, it was just eat, sleep, training, and school.
Yeah.
In 1988, getting ready for the Night of Champions and the Olympia, it was trying to figure out the pro career, flying around, making a little bit of money, having a little bit of freedom and independence, and also feeling like an adult because I wasn't living with my parents. I was coming and going.
Odd to hear, but true.
No, but it is. I was like 22 years old. I'm like, I'm going home to my own place. I'm going to have a girl over tonight. I'm going to go over here. I'm going to go there. And I didn't have the discipline of just eat, sleeping, and training. And in my ignorance, I wound up in fourth place at the Night of Champions against some great guys. Mm. And then I wound up outside the top 10 of the Olympia, which I actually accepted. I'm like, but look at the guys ahead of me. And John Brown and all the people that I respected, Mike Christian too, were going, you should have been in the top five. What the hell? You can't. You should have been in the top five. So then the hangover comes afterwards when I come back and I start replaying in my mind that had I put the effort and put the sweat equity in, it could have been a better experience for me. Instead, I was just a fan with a free ticket to stand on stage and put oil on the back of Gary Stridham. I swore then, if I ever make it back to the Olympia, it's going to be a ball game, and I wound up in third in 1990.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. That's a great story. I love it. I love it. You got a free ticket to put oil on Gary Stridham's back. I love it. I know. It's funny because I remember at Night of Champions, I was looking around. I'm like, I need somebody to oil me. And it's like, Robbie Robinson's oiling my back. I'm like, freaking Robbie Robinson's putting oil on my back, man. I couldn't believe it.
Starstruck in 1988 on the bus ride over there. Remember, I wound up – this was the show in Los Angeles, but I went by myself. It was the day before my birthday. My mom's mom, my grandmother, had died on my birthday. So my whole family was home. She was there convalescing, and they knew she was on her way out. But it happened to be Olympia weekend, and she died while we're doing the weigh-ins in our boxing robes, right?
Yeah.
Wayne Amelia had us out in our boxing robes. We stripped down. It's the first time we're ever getting weighed in. And I had all the pictures of the guys on my room at my place at home. So I was too fanboyish to be on that level, and also I was not a believer that I deserved to be in that top 10. But when you stand there and your name's not getting called out, you go home and you go to the drawing board. I went back like a blacksmith. I was going to work. I wasn't playing around. I was not going to be denied. And of course, that made all the difference by the time I showed up on stage at the night at the Pro Ironman where I won my first pro show. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but 88 was memorable, man. I mean, those guys, I'm sure those guys weren't paying attention to me because I was a new kid on the block, but to be sitting next to Bob on the bus with his buddy Rod, was it Bob and Rod, I think?
Rod, yeah.
Yeah, and there was, I think, Mohammed Benaziza. We had Mike Ashley was there and Samir Badu. I mean, dude, that was enough for me. I was like, I made it. I was good. Wait till I get back and tell everybody who I hung out with over the weekend, you know? I
was a fan. Absolutely, man.
I was a fan.
Well, I'm glad to hear you had that perspective as well. It wasn't just me. No.
I think all of us that have that opportunity, where it's like, first of all, it's validation when we arrive there.
Yeah.
But then it becomes an acceptance thing. These guys accepted me into that circle from that moment on. All of those guys, when I ran into them, I was one of them. Suddenly I was respected and brought into the group. And that was the validation for all those, you know, chicken breast and stinky fish and late night workouts, early morning workouts. I mean, just to be recognized and accepted by those guys, that validated my entire career in 1988.
Yeah.
And I was at my worst and I was absolutely horrible. And that's the memory that stands out more than all that other stuff. It's all a blur after that.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, guys. Well, we're going to wrap it up here. I want to thank you guys for joining me late on a Monday night. Tom Terwilliger, you got a new book out called 7-Step Comeback Plan. Where do they get that, Tom?
You can actually download it free right now, which is pretty cool. Okay. Go to thecomebackplan.com, thecomebackplan.com, and just download it. I'd love for you to have it. I created the book. I wrote it specifically for what's happening right now with this disruption shutdown. because I think a lot of people are still in fear, doubt, and uncertainty, and it's creating anxiety. And where do we go from here? What do we do? How do I get out of this? You know, and when you get stuck in that state, it's hard to take action. So this is a template for creating an action plan specifically for you. And so I wanted people to have something, a tool in many respects. Of course, there's other tools available, but I wanted to create something that we can, hey, you know what? Here's something to get you out of that state and into action. Because as soon as you get into action, all that other stuff evaporates and you start to see the opportunities that are available. So thecomebackplan.com. Love for you to download it, man.
All right.
Very nice.
And Sean, thank you for joining us again. It's always great to hear from you. Thanks for coming up with that idea for where we could talk about the posing, especially from that 88 Olympia, and hopefully
absolutely
back on some of our future Olympia prospects, so they'll be inspired by this.
Yeah. All right, boys. I'll see you back on the other side of this, on the other side of the virus at some contest. I don't know where.
Yeah,
but we gotta get back to normal.
Well, hopefully we'll all be at the Olympia, so we got that in December.
Hey, John, right. Let me just take a quick second to thank you, man, for, number one, putting all this stuff together and doing some really great podcasting and having, I mean, just chatting with some of the guys that go back and the newer guys. I mean, it's just what you're doing is keeping the sport fresh. It's allowing us to share some memories and some tools and some strategies. So, you know, and again, you're not just somebody doing this. You're freaking John Hansen doing this, and I think we're all honored to be
natural
part of
it. Mr. Olympia doing
that's
this.
Right, man. That's
appreciate awesome. You, man.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
All right, guys.
Thank you, Sean. See you later, Sean. Be good, brother. Be safe.
Right on. Thank you, guys.
All right. Take care, guys. Bye-bye. All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you to our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, for sponsoring this episode. Thank you also to our Patreon donors who generously donate money each month to the podcast. So thank you guys very much. If you are interested in being a Patreon donor, you just go to the website bodybuildinglegendshow.com, and in the upper right-hand corner, you will see the Patreon link. You can donate as little as $5 a month if you like. And I appreciate anybody who does that. You guys really help us keep going. But next week, we will be joined by the great Lee Haney and Rich Gaspari, and they're going to talk about their training together in 1984 when Lee won the Mr. Olympia and Rich won the Mr. Universe and got his pro card. All right, that's it. Hope you guys have a fabulous week. Stay safe out there. I hope you're back to training and you're having great workouts. And we will see you guys next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Take care.